You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, January 27th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, David Dayen. On what liberal attacks on Bernie Sanders are really about. Also on the program today, one dead, half of Al-Qaeda in jail, standoff continues in that Oregon Wildlife Reserve. Meanwhile, an equally disturbing standoff between Donald Trump and Fox News. Fox News acting incredibly inappropriately and low class.
Disrespectful. Losers.
To the Donald. And the Donald saying, I guess I'm going to give my ratings to somebody else.
I'll have my own event. It'll be great. It'll be great.
Meanwhile, another Democratic debate, this time unsanctioned by MSNBC. In New Hampshire, not so fast. The DNC drops the hammer. While at the same time, the DNC head Debbie Wasserman Schultz salutes Mike Bloomberg. And a shooting follows a shooter, making a theater a hard target. How fear of being in a soft target makes an otherwise soft target a hard target and then ends up with a shooting. I don't know. There should be a word for that. I don't know what that word is. All this and more on today's program. I don't know if we ever got to the Planned Parenthood stories and those Supreme Court and POTUS, I should say President of the United States, reforms on criminal justice. We will get to those in a moment. But let's talk about that story. This is, there's, you know, and obviously it's sad when anybody gets shot. And this guy who did get shot and died up at this wildlife reserve, I mean, he had basically gone on television and said, I'm not being taken alive. I mean, this guy looked like he was really, you know, this was, I don't want to call it a suicide, but it did seem like this is how the guy wanted to go out and was determined to do it. I mean, look, it was, no one thought, well, I don't know what these guys thought. I mean, I still can't quite figure out how they thought this was going to end. That they were going to be given the wildlife reserve? Yeah, you guys can have it. Just, you know, don't charge too much when people want to come. They get to set up hunting tours there. They get to, you know, they get to be guides and hunt some of the endangered wildlife and birds there. The bird hunting. But you'll remember Robert Lavoie Finicum. He was interviewed on MSNBC. By actually a reporter who I think used to live in my building. And he was the guy with the tarp and sitting in the lawn chair saying, you know, with his gun, like, I'm not going to be taken into custody. I'm never going to live in a box. I mean, which was weird because he had no problem living in a federally owned space, right? I mean, it's just, I guess it was just the size. They won't let me bring my lawn chair into prison. And he was killed. Robert Lavoie Finicum. It's unclear how he died. According to someone who sort of heard secondhand, I guess, it was, of course, he was summarily executed, which I find very hard to believe, but I guess we'll find out. My dad was a good, good man through and through, says Ariana Finicum Brown, 26, one of Finicum's 11 children. He would never, ever want to hurt somebody, but he does believe in defending freedom, and he knew the risks involved. I mean, there was an interview with him with the Oregonian, I think it was, or at least it played on there, saying that he sensed that the feds were starting to get pressure to do something. I don't know how he thought he was defending freedom. Seemed like a smart guy, seemed like a fairly nice guy, but, you know, all it takes is one faulty assumption or premise at the beginning of that. Then the rest follows from there. Ryan Bundy, one of the Bundy brothers, suffered a minor gunshot wound. Also arrested his brother, Eamon Bundy, Brian Cavalier, Shauna Cox, Ryan Payne. They were all charged with conspiracy to impede federal officers. Apparently, John Reitheimer surrendered to police in Arizona on the conspiracy charge. So he must have, like, snuck away. Apparently,
that guy is not down for the cause at all.
He was reselling a lot of those sexual toys, sex toys,
right.
And he couldn't get eBay to pick up, he couldn't get deliveries from the reserve, so.
I respect contracts, so I gotta go.
That's right. And apparently there are still, and no one's quite clear how many are militants of Al-Qaeda, or whatever they call themselves.
Al-Qaeda.
Mahler at the Mahler National Wildlife Refuge. They are still stuck up there. Apparently what's happened is federal authorities were getting a lot of pressure from local authorities to do something. They arrested those seven on a highway bound for John Day, which I guess is a town in Oregon. They were scheduled to participate in an evening community meeting set up by local residents. A crowd of several hundred had gathered at the John Day Senior Center and were subsequently told their guest speakers would not be appearing. So now what seems is that the FBI and federal authorities have basically surrounded, and I think there's not within close proximity, but have basically cut off all routes to the center. Apparently these guys were able, they were under the notion that they could just come and go as they pleased. Now nobody can get there because there have been calls that have been put out from various nut job groups to go and stand with these guys. It's unclear what happens next. Hopefully they just get into their pickups or their whatever it is they're driving and their Yukons or their Denalis or their Ford Escapes and drive down and say, we give up. We had our fun. We had our camping trip. Spent all that time with all the sex toys without our family around. And that's that. And this thing ends without anybody else getting hurt. But who knows? You know, these guys want to go down in history. They're not going to. I mean, I remember that Finicum guy, but that's basically because I was like, oh, my God, I think I know that reporter who was interviewing him.
Can I ask a question that I think is burning on everybody's minds?
What's that?
Is there any report of the sumo wrestler guy specifically?
You know what? I mean, one has to wonder if the sumo wrestler video wasn't the thing that pushed them over the edge. But no report. I mean, I guess my sense is he's not traveling that much. He's probably, you know, prepping.
Or I'm going to hold the fort down.
Yeah. I'm going to hang out here. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, David Dayan on what liberal attacks on Bernie Sanders are really about. We'll be right back after this.
Well, everybody in the bank line knows that I got a crush on the new teller. It's plain as day, I might as well tell her. She looks my way and she knows quite well her. Well, everybody in the other lines, they smile at me the way I'm blushing. I let them pass me cause I'm not rushing. I got a crush on the new teller. She looks at me and she knows. There's only three in the other lines. In my line, well, I count 11. Well, that's fine cause I'm in heaven. And I got a crush on the new teller. And she looks at me and she knows. Let's go.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, ladies and gentlemen. It is always, always a pleasure to welcome this man to the program. He is a writer who contributes at The New Republic, The Intercept, The Fiscal Times, just about anywhere online. I mean, a Salon, and on and on. He is also the author of the forthcoming, what is the forthcoming book? It's a Chain of Title, isn't it? When is it coming out?
Yeah, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, and it will drop May 17th.
May 17th, and now available for pre-order. David Dayan, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
All right, so you wrote a piece. I mean, we're hearing quite a bit. But one of the big things that we've heard on the in terms of the debates between Sanders and Hillary Clinton, so much of it has focused and centered around Wall Street, her relationship to Wall Street, his proposals to regulate Wall Street. And you write about this dynamic, and specifically your entry point is the recent, and I think I made this comment on Chris Hayes' show like a week or a week and a half ago. It seemed like on one day, within like a 2 or 3 day period, every single potential supporter for Hillary Clinton got a phone call, and basically we're told or on some type of, you know, email blast, hey, if you got anything, now's the time to use it.
I get all my good ideas from you, Sam.
Well, I'm not suggesting that at all. but you were responding to some arguments on the from the sort of the from liberal critics of Bernie Sanders' notion of a 21st century Glass-Steagall or a new Glass-Steagall bill. And take it from there. I mean,
I guess here's my problem. I mean, I agree with you that there was sort of a siren call, a bat signal or something that went out to say, you know, it's time to tamp down everyone's hopes. I think there's a piece in Jacobin that calls it a, you know, base management strategy. That it was time to get everyone to off this idea of good public policy ideas. And it sort of ran the gamut of these sort of liberal wonk pundits, Paul Krugman being sort of at the top of that chain. And my problem,
and then we
is,
should say, I mean, just yeah. to be clear here, and first, and I, for I was talking even broader that from like Claire McCaskill, David Brock, we heard from all
oh,
of
sure.
the players,
sure.
and it's not. I mean, there's well, I guess from my well. I mean, obviously with David Brock and Claire McCaskill, they're clearly surrogates. I don't know that Paul Krugman is a surrogate, and he certainly hasn't identified himself. And who knows if he's gotten that thing? But I wouldn't one would
I mean, not necessarily. But my here's my larger point that it's not a problem. It's a reasonable sort of ideological position to say that we have to think about the bounds of the possible, and that we're entering a period where Republicans are likely to control the House of Representatives for the next 4 years, and we need to think in terms of choosing a nominee for president, someone that has this recognition of the sort of grinded out way in which government is going to work for the next 4 years. Okay, you can take that position. That's fine. The problem I have is when this carries over into not just attacking Sanders for various policies which may not be realizable, which were maybe too idealistic. It's when it carries over into saying that these are bad ideas. It's wrong to stretch your wings. It's wrong to think big. It's simply out of the bounds of reasonable discussion to come up with things that are, outside the narrow range of acceptable policies. That's a problem, because that's a problem that endures well beyond any nomination fight.
Right.
And in this case, when you're talking about Wall Street reform, when you're going after Bernie Sanders for hippy-dippy ideas that would never fly in the real world, you're not attacking Sanders. You're attacking Elizabeth Warren. I mean, this is when you're attacking the idea that we could restore this separation between investment and commercial banking. That's Warren's bill. That's not Sanders' bill. It's a bipartisan bill, by the way. It's a Warren-McCain bill. And so that is the bigger problem to me, is that you're going against a consensus all over the world that it's a pretty good idea to segregate these assets and make sure taxpayers aren't on the hook when there are major risks that are taken by traders and bankers. And, I don't understand why that is seen as completely outside the bounds of discussion when it's being implemented in Europe, it's being implemented in
well,
the
wait
United
a second. All right, let's back up.
And
let's
it's being implemented in the United States. But
let's back up
ahead.
Because I want people to understand when they hear this rhetoric, when they hear people say, I mean, the two biggest things that you hear in response to the idea of a 21st century Glass-Steagall. Sometimes people just say, bring back Glass-Steagall. The two biggest things you hear are, one, Glass-Steagall would not have stopped the 2008 crisis anyways. And two,
which is misdirection and a parlor game. It's just something that's played to get you off the track. It's first of all, you can have all kinds of arguments about that. Usually the people that argue that say, well, you can't say that because AIG wasn't a bank, but AIG, for the purposes of the federal government, was a bank. They owned a thrift. They were regulated as a bank. They wouldn't have been able to pick their own regulator that was the Office of Thrift Supervision if it wasn't for the elimination of Glass-Steagall. There's usually a lot of misdirection in that argument. As I said, it's a parlor game. It's largely opinion-based, it's largely subjective, and it's meant to throw you off this track of the very simple idea that if you have deposits that people make all over the country by the millions, that that money should not be used as a coffer to take incredible risks, especially because that money is insured by the federal government.
All right, before we even get to that, I want to even get to sort of the broader, more conceptual, because I remember that these types of questions were being asked coming out of, you know, from the Occupy Wall Street, and specifically, I think it was the Occupy Wall Street Banking Committee or Financial Reform Committee that did submitted a very detailed, extensive, probably the most detailed and extensive comment as the question as to whether or not to reinstitute the Volcker rule was being debated. And there was, at least structurally speaking, and like you say, people can debate as to whether or not Glass-Steagall it was a but-for in terms of the 2008 crisis. But as you argue, and as Dean Baker argues, doing his own sort of version of a subtweet, that misses the point. Because the likelihood of the next financial crisis working exactly like the last financial crisis is nil.
Right.
Because
right. And it distracts from the main point of what the question we should be asking is, what is the optimal way of having a financial system? What should the financial system do? How should it benefit the country? And how should government seek to stabilize it? Because finance almost inherently is a destabilizing force. So once you understand that, you realize that this question of whether Glass-Steagall's repeal caused the crisis is a complete red herring.
Right.
It's just a total red herring.
I mean, because The important point is that what 2008 showed us was the danger inherent in the way our financial sector is structured.
Correct.
Now. And
how it's structured is very important for you to say the word structured, because it was not about the fact that these institutions were too big to fail. It was the fact that these institutions were too interconnected to fail. Lehman Brothers was not necessarily a big financial institution in terms of raw size, but it was connected through its counterparties to practically every other part of the financial system. And we had something, there's a concept called tight coupling. And what that means is that tight coupling is that if there's a failure some part in a system, think of it as plumbing, right, in a designed, engineered system. If there's a failure in one part of it, it brings down the whole system. That means the system isn't resilient enough to handle failures, which are somewhat inevitable in some sense. So that's the problem with the financial system. That was the problem, and that continues to be the problem, because we still have a very interconnected financial system that is tightly coupled.
And let me also, I want to belabor this point of how one approaches this, because one of the things I remember... Alexis Goldstein actually joined Michael on this program a couple of weeks ago. One of the things I remember coming out of that that working group was this idea that the broad concept of either trying to statutorily structure our banking system in a certain way versus the idea of regulations that are supposed to sort of trim the sails in certain places where, and certainly the one thing that has become clear, and, you know, there's another bill winding its way through Congress right now, that, that it is very, if you are a bank and, or if you don't want any curtailment on your ability to do anything, you want regulations to be proposed rather than broad statutorial changes in your structure, because it gives you more room. I mean, just expand on that a little bit so that people really understand this concept, and then let's go into the specifics of what the 21st century Glass-Steagall Act would look like.
Absolutely. So you have structural reform. What you're talking about is structural reform versus, you know, I guess the $10 word is macroprudential regulation. And the problem with regulation is that it depends on both the will, the expertise, and the resources of the regulators. And a lot of these concepts are very dicey, and they're hard to get your arms around. It, it you know, it's difficult for a regulator to handle a system that is so complex and has so many interlocking parts. You make it easier on regulators to do their job if you come up with structural redesigns that are, you know, big dumb reforms, basically, that say these assets go over here and these assets go over here and they cannot be segregated in any form, shape, or fashion. That's a much easier thing to regulate than to put some sort of risk assessment on some portion of some assets and to make sure there's capital requirements on various Tier 1 assets, but they're risk-weighted and they're based on a formula. I mean, you essentially kill the regulation with complexity.
And we should say, this is not about intellectual capacity. The bottom line is, whenever we hear of Wall Street lawyers and firms challenging these regulations, they're not challenging them on some type of constitutional grounds. They're challenging them as to whether or not the regulators have the authority based upon the statute, whether or not they've done. I mean, one of the things that wants to be implemented in this new Warner bill, among others, is there has to be a cost-benefit analysis. They get them on all the technicalities, and they threaten
them. And it's asymmetrical warfare, too, right? I mean, there's a part in my book where Arthur Levitt, who used to be the chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, says there are as many lawyers at the Securities and Exchange Commission as there are at one mid-sized Wall Street bank.
Right.
You know, I mean, you're just outgunned as a regulator if you're put into these boxes. If you have a simple job and you know exactly what you're looking for, and as we'll see in the Warren bill, there are very specific ways in which bankers and executives are put on the hook to ensure that they follow those laws, then you just make the system much easier to police.
Right. And so, in other words, these broad statutes that simply say, we're going to divide the banks. You know, you can't do X, you can't do Y. We're not going to finesse any of this. We're not going to hand it over to regulators to develop the ways to get to. So, in other words, everybody.
And there's a supplementary point to that. And the supplementary point is that ultimately what you're doing is you're trying to choke away the unproductive nature of finance. You're trying to have what we want is less of this trading that is not socially useful but just pools risk more and more and threatens the rest of the economy. That's what we want. So how do you do that? Well, you cut off its sources of funding. And a couple of the key sources of funding are A, deposits, and B, government subsidies through the forms of insurance or cheap funding. So that's the idea, and that's where the similarities between, you know, the idea of regulating and putting capital requirements on shadow banks and all financial institutions that represent a threat, that's where the similarity comes in with simply segregating the system. Both are trying to get at reducing this unproductive trading by cutting off some funding sources, or at least, you know, ensuring that the funding is harder to get. The regulating, we've described the difference between the two types of theories. Regulating it subjects it to discretionary forces and subjects it to the endless kind of warfare with giant banks that have the staff to have this flotilla of lawyers because they're giant institutions that have not been cut down to size. You know, I feel like the other approach is the better approach.
Now, so from the perspective, and I tend to agree with you on that, I mean, particularly having just interviewed people on so many times about how specific provisions of Dodd-Frank are, you know, still not implemented because, and will never be implemented because they're tied up in all of those sort of obstacles. But
absolutely.
So for the most part, can we say that this is not an instance, because I think there's a lot of policy areas where there's a big mistake made in assuming that two sides of this argument want the same goal. It's just a question of how to get there. In the context of regulating finance, for the most part, or at least I guess on the left, would you, is it your perspective that people want to more or less get to the same place, more or less? There may be some, in terms of the less, it may be a function of a lot of their friends are bankers, and what they're afraid of is that, well, you're going to really inhibit our business. I'm not quite sure why that's a bad thing.
They might sincerely believe or might want to profess that they want to get to the same place. The problem is what gets you there. You know, what will get you to the same place? And my belief is that you have a much better opportunity to do that when you restrict banking to the traditional forms that actually improve the necessary forms that are necessary for the economy to function. When you restrict it to that, and then when you and that doesn't mean taking your eye off these other forms of investment banking and hedge fund activity and things like that, because I think there was this sleight of hand that has been
well
done.
Yeah, I want to get into that. Okay, so when people say, like, no, the issue is shadow banking, it's not conventional banking. Lehman Brothers was small. Now, you've made the argument that, well, Lehman Brothers may have been relatively small. They were in a locus of interconnections that that was very problematic. But tell us what shadow banking is, and tell us why you don't think saying, but you're not dealing with shadow banking, is really a good parry to the proposal of a 21st century Glass-Steagall Act. And when we say 21st century Glass-Steagall Act, that's not a general term. That's a specific thing
specific piece of legislation that Elizabeth Warren has put forward. It's a 30-page bill. You can read it. If you go to my piece of the Fiscal Times, I have a link to it. So shadow banks are typically discussed as financial institutions that do bank-like activities outside of the regulatory perimeter, outside of the kinds of regulations that banks are subject to. And that could be hedge fund activity, that could be private equity, it could be special purpose vehicles for funding, all kinds of things. And the one argument that I guess is most commonly put forward by people like Mike Consul is that if you just bring them into the regulatory perimeter, if you just expand that, then you're done. That's enough to, as long as they're subject to the same forces banks are subject to, then we'll have a safer and more stable system. My feeling is that there's no reason not to do both. The idea that if you go the sort of restoring Glass-Steagall way, where you separate those activities, the funding of those activities, you're separating the assets, that doesn't mean you're leaving one set of assets outside the regulatory safety net, that you're not monitoring them at all, and that you're not seeing the ways in which they feed back into the system or into the economy. You're just segregating the assets. And the goal of segregating those assets, as I said, is to cut off the funding sources. Because if you cut away the bank deposits, if you cut away subsidies, government subsidies through insurance and other forms, there's just less money available for the shadow banking activity. And really, a lot of shadow banking activity should just be eliminated. I mean, there is no reason for it, really. You cannot come up with a theory other than it makes a few people a lot of money for why it needs to be part of our financial system as a whole. And so you can either try to directly restrict some of those activities, and there was a bill, I remember, in Dodd-Frank, that Byron Dorgan wrote to get rid of naked credit default swaps, which is, I don't want to go into the whole technicality of that, but basically this just gambling. I mean, it's just sort of betting on something without holding the underlying asset at all.
Side bets. Side bets.
Yeah, side bets. Exactly.
You play this in poker. Like, I'm going to bet, yeah, I'm out of this hand, but I'm going to bet Sam's going to have a full house.
There you go. So you could either eliminate that activity, or you could choke off the oxygen for it. And what Elizabeth Warren's bill does, in several ways, is try to choke off the oxygen for this kind of activity. And that's why you segregate it, number one. And the second reason is you segregate it because you start to get at the interconnection problem. That you segregate it because if, even despite our regulation, despite whatever, some sort of shadow bank, some sort of institution that engages in shadow banking activity fails, it doesn't affect the entire system. It doesn't affect every bank that carries trillions of dollars in deposits and then slips into the real economy. You want to remove this interconnection. You want to have a system that's resilient. And I feel like reinstituting this kind of Glass-Steagall idea is part of that.
So how would you characterize, I mean, the aside from the argument that, well, I mean, if you had Glass-Steagall, it wouldn't have stopped 2008, which is really not an argument for not doing it in the future. Is there an argument out there that you think is, that is sincere in terms of sharing the same goal that we're talking about?
Well, I mean, Mike Consul makes this argument, and I believe him to be sincere, and you can say that it's, that you can assess it for yourself. My problem is,
well, what argument is it that he makes? Tell people
the argument is that we need to extend the regulatory perimeter to shadow banks, that we need to impose the same kind of capital requirements, the same kind of regulation that we impose on banks on the shadow banking sector, and that would aid safety and stability. And that's fine. That's a fine argument to make.
Why is it mutually exclusive?
My real problem is, number one, that. Why is it mutually exclusive? My second problem is the arguments that are being made to say, no, we don't go to Glass-Steagall, are very broad arguments that are made against parts of that could be made against parts of Dodd-Frank today that are in place that deal with the segregating of assets. For example, the Volcker Rule. The Volcker Rule is kind of a miniature version of Glass-Steagall. It separates what's called proprietary trading, which is trading, a bank trading on their own account for their own purposes, for the purposes of making money, rather than doing it on behalf of a client or a customer. It segregates that out away from a deposit-taking institution. In the Volcker Rule, there's one loophole which allows a bank to invest up to 3% of the total assets of a hedge fund. There are proposals to close that hedge fund loophole. Hillary Clinton has proposed to close that hedge fund loophole, which would further segregate those assets. And there's the swaps push-out rule, which was in Dodd-Frank before it was repealed with a bill that was written by Citigroup lobbyists back in the end of 2014. Swaps push-out would say that if you want to trade in derivatives, your derivatives trading desk has to be segregated into a separate institution that is separately capitalized, separate from a big bank, because the four big banks, do virtually all swaps and derivatives trading. So those things are examples of this principle that, to make the system safer, you segregate out the assets. The problem is that the people who are arguing against Glass-Steagall are arguing against it in the exact same ways that opponents of the Volcker Rule and these other forms of segregating assets have been doing. And, Paul Krugman, when he argued to not get rid of the swaps push-out rule, was on the other side of that. So what he's arguing now is the exact opposite of what he argued at the end of 2014.
So is he arguing against the principle or just saying that?
The principle, that's the problem. If they were just saying, okay, you can segregate some assets, but Glass-Steagall takes you too far, then that's a reasonable argument. We can have a discussion about that. He's arguing against the principle
that segregating these assets are irrelevant.
Segregating these assets is just irrelevant, wrong, and actually makes the system more dangerous, which is really a problem, because now you're not just calling into question this extension of financial reform through Glass-Steagall restoration. You're calling into question things that are in the system right now and are actually having an underrated effect in making the system a little bit safer.
And it's
super dangerous what he's doing right now.
And what you don't want is Jamie Dimon coming in and saying, like, even Paul Krugman agrees with me that this segregation is not necessary.
And I feel like it's coming from a position of ignorance. And you know, that may sound harsh when I'm talking about Paul Krugman, the sage Paul Krugman. I don't think he knows what he's talking about when it comes to I don't think he's ever read the 21st Century Glass-Steagall bill. And I don't think that he understands that what he's doing right now is really, really harmful.
And we should say that, at the very least, I don't know if Krugman has responded to this. And like I say, you know, I read something from Dean.
No, he's responded, but through subtweeting and name-calling pretty much exclusively. And, you know, for someone who prides himself in intellectual honesty, I think it's a sad moment.
And we should say that Mike Konzel has responded, and his argument seems to be one of
his
prioritization.
Of a substantive matter, we can have discussions about that. My problem with him is that, once again, the distinction is not being made clear. There's a distinction here between arguing that the particular Glass-Steagall 21st Century bill is problematic or irrelevant or goes too far, and saying that all segregation of assets, which you know, is not just in the American system that we have right now, but is in the system that they're putting together in the UK, where they call it ring fencing deposits. In other words, making sure that no taxpayer insured money is involved in any kind of investment banking activities. It's also happening in Europe. And so there's this, like, global consensus that it's a pretty good idea to segregate these asset classes and make sure that there's no cross-subsidies for risk-taking from the government. So my problem is the lack of distinction that's being made there. And I think it's a really important principle.
Yeah, and let's just talk a little bit more broadly about this, because, you know, the idea of, you know, one of the arguments that we hear now relative to Bernie Sanders' proposals, and we're hearing these critiques in the context of the primary race, of course, is that. I mean, there's two major critiques I hear about Bernie Sanders, or three, I should say.
Right.
One is he's unelectable because he's a socialist. Let's put that aside for a moment. The other is that his policy agenda is fantastical. Even though people subscribe to these things on a polling
right.
level, they claim to, more or less. I mean, maybe people don't realize that their taxes are going to go up if they have single payer, although I think Bernie Sanders has begun to at least address that and embrace it and explain it. But at least they purport to appreciate it. But they're so fantastical because of the nature of our political system now. We're living in an age of gridlock and polarization. And the third one might be he doesn't seem to be engaged in foreign policy. Let's put aside the first and the third, the foreign policy one and this notion of Americans, you know, socialism. You might as well be an atheist Muslim Jew who's gay
right.
and married and
right.
I don't know what else after that.
Right.
So talk about this idea, because you've got a piece in the New Republic that you know, sort of dovetails a little bit with this, and not so much the 21st Century Glass-Steagall. Like you say, there's already bipartisan support for this. But the idea that his proposals are so fantastical. We need to be more pragmatic in the way that these are proposed. Right. I mean, talk about it both from a political theory of change perspective, but also in terms of like, you know, you could be slightly less, you could be slightly more pragmatic, and you're still not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, I mean that's definitely true. So once again, you can make your argument for pragmatism and back it up if you want to. My problem comes in when you start to say it's not, when it starts to bleed over. It's not just about Sanders, but it's about anyone who makes an idealistic argument ever that is, you know, the problem here. And I use the example of during the healthcare debate, where Bernie Sanders certainly was a single-payer supporter, tried to get an amendment into the bill that replaced it all with a single-payer program. Obviously, that didn't get a vote. But when he saw that he had an opportunity, because there were 60 senators and they needed every single one of them, so everyone became an agent for, you know, some particular policy. If they wanted to get it in, it was the only way to get the bill passed. He became an evangelist for these things called community health centers. And, I mean, if you can look at single payer, but community health centers are more like socialized medicine that we have at the National Health Service in Britain. Community health centers are, they're all over the country. There are over 1,300 networks with over 9,200 locations. They serve all patients, regardless of the ability to pay, regardless of whether they carry insurance. About a third of their patients are uninsured. About 40% are on Medicaid. And they serve about 24 million customers a year now. Now, in 2000, they served maybe 10 million. The reason for this huge expansion is that Bernie Sanders said, I'm not voting for this bill unless you give a lot of money to community health centers. And he got $11 billion for community health centers, which was about double their appropriation at that time. And it enabled them to double their access for sort of primary care for millions and millions of people in a way that is much more akin to socialized medicine than single payer. And this, you know, the idea that he's some hippy-dippy who just has his head in the clouds and has no ideas that could ever reach fruition has to wrestle with this, that he was the primary mover in getting us to a system of a health safety net that is now so durable and such a part of our health system that even Republican senators fight for this. You know, when there was going to be a cliff, he got 5 years of funding when it was going to run out last year. And Republican senators joined with Sanders to sign on to fight so that cliff wouldn't happen and that this would be a continuing appropriation. And they succeeded. Now it's funded through to next year. So, you know,
the point being that he's not someone who is... I want the whole sandwich or nothing. The guy has shown he advocates for the whole sandwich, and if he sees an opportunity to get a quarter of a sandwich, he'll take a quarter of a sandwich and maintain.
I don't even know if it's a quarter of a sandwich.
Half a sandwich.
It's like it's one and a half sandwiches. Okay. This is more single payer than single payer, what we're talking about. And it directly impacts the lives of one in, I think, 13 Americans. That's really significant, and it completely accords with all the principles that he has put forward. This is ensuring that everybody, no matter their status or their income, can get covered and get care. And it's critically an important part of our health safety net. So, you know, you can say all you want, aim low, forget about all this, we got to get out of the system, whatever we can get. You can't be a dreamer in American politics. It's just wrong. It's wrong politically, I feel, but that you can argue with. It's wrong on the policy merits, and I think this point about community health centers shows that.
David Dayan, always a pleasure. Folks, we will link to David's Tumblr, which is basically what I do at the beginning. Well, it's really not really, frankly, to be, it's not enough to just do it on a Monday, because by midweek, you've got another half dozen stories on a different half dozen publications. But we will link to your Tumblr, which is sort of the one-stop shopping portal for David Dayan's work. David, always a pleasure.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sam.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break here. First, let me remind you of this. This show is listener-supported. Not in the NPR way. We're not like that NPR stuff. We don't tote bags, although we actually still have a bunch of supermarket bags left over from our thing. We should actually contemplate selling all those supermarket bags. We don't have tote bags. We have supermarket bags. That's my point. That's
more
my
practical.
Point. That's my point. Right. We're more specific. We don't give a bag out and say, do with it what you want. We tell you, this is a bag you take to the supermarket.
It's a command and control program.
That's right. That's right. We don't allow you any type of autonomy.
We don't believe in freedom of choice.
That's right.
You know, when libertarians
we are so anti-liberty at this place.
Yeah.
And you'll find that once we send you to our re-education camp, yeah, we teach you the benefit of us telling you what to do with your specific bags. You have a bag that you take down to the gym. You have a bag that you take to pick up the kids. You have a bag that you take to the supermarket. And then what we do when you become more advanced, we actually show you how to construct a specific place in your closet to place each bag.
Your life will be better because of these orders.
This type of orthodoxy.
These commands.
You're not going to have to get up and answer a question. Then soon we move on to, like, you know, what clothes you wear, right, and
what you read.
It
how
will
you think.
All be actually Majority Report t-shirts.
One size fits all.
No, you'll have different sizes. Let's not. We have multiple sizes.
One size when it comes to the t-shirts.
You got
to
remember the marketing aspect of this as well. We have multiple sizes on the t-shirts. We need to make a store. We got to get around to that. Like we don't have enough to do around here. Gosh, I can't. Now I'm depressed.
But when someone calls up, the point is that when someone calls up and they say,
"See, this is my point.
Do you believe in freedom?"
This is my point. NPR, depressing. Us, not depressing. NPR, it's just you start thinking about the tote bags and all you end up doing is feeling bad about yourself. With us, you feel good about yourself.
Somehow we start talking about our grocery bags and we feel bad about ourselves.
That's my point.
Yeah, there you go.
So the bottom line is join themajorityreport.com. For just pennies a day, you can not only continue these deep dives into policy, these great interviews, but also like little moments like this, where we show you how depressing NPR can be. This is their tote bags. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Buy your stuff from jet.com. Do it through our link. Go to majorityreportkickback.com. You can buy your stuff at Jet. If you've never tried jet.com, now's the time to try it. You get 15% off your first order. Still use Amazon? Well, why not pick up a rototiller? Spring's coming soon. Make sure you know how to work it before spring comes, and buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Just a programmatic reminder, Thursday night, we will be doing, that's tomorrow night, we're going to be doing a live debate coverage, even though Donald Trump, maybe we'll do Donald Trump's wounded warrior. We'll see.
I think we're going to have to flip back and forth. There's only so much that we can take without Trump, right?
I don't know.
We'll hang about in there to see what Jeb Bush's pre-canned line about Trump not being there is.
Right, right. I'm not afraid of you.
Yeah, he was afraid to debate me.
I'm not afraid of you, Megyn Kelly. You're great.
You're pretty hot. The most authentic moment
of
Jeb's campaign.
That's a Supergirl comment. I had somebody, a buddy of mine.
Yes.
Had a friend listen to the show.
Yes.
And she reacted by saying, this guy sounds, this is like the 1950s because, well, first of all, it sounds to me like she misinterpreted, but I said one of Hillary Clinton's qualifications for president is that she's has the most experience of just about anyone in terms of what it takes to be president because she was first lady. And she felt that was sexist in some fashion.
Busted.
Well,
I'm kidding.
I know, but I mean, I think that's ridiculous.
That isn't exactly what you said. That isn't exactly what you said. It wasn't that you said. You said that she was the top confidant to the president of the United States. You didn't just say that.
She was the top confidant because she was the first lady.
Well, exactly. But I mean that.
No,
well,
but I don't have a problem with me phrasing.
Not all first ladies are the top confidant.
That's probably
true. She was
Hillary
a political.
That's probably true. That's probably
Hillary
true.
Hillary Clinton.
That's
what
true.
What you said was even, definitely not
But
sexist.
Even if I had said first lady, I'm sorry. You live with somebody.
You can ignore it. Whatever they're doing.
I think it's
like,
harder.
Oh, running the country,
I think it's a
whatever.
Little bit. I think it's a little harder to do that.
There's a lot of rooms in the White House.
That's true. I mean, I can tell
Michelle,
you.
What'd you say?
I can tell you that the first lady of the Majority Report has no idea what I do.
Yeah, but that's through her sort of sheer disinterest.
Yes,
that's a kind of power play on her part.
If I was president, she would not be able to avoid it.
I was forced
another State of the Union.
Listen to what you to exactly what you said several
times. What do you mean forced to listen to it?
is it because of our training program? No, because I was cutting the video.
Okay, well, you weren't forced to do that. That's part of that's what your job is.
Okay, no one was had a gun to my head. No, I listen.
Well, no one's forcing you to do it anyway.
Oh gosh, I listened. I re-listened to what you said. So,
right. Thank you.
I would like to say that I disagree with that completely because everything you said was completely right about why
and
she
then,
is qualified.
Then apparently she took issue with the fact that I said conservatives needed an authoritarian daddy figure, and that was somehow sexist.
Well, it sounds bad.
Now what?
It sounds bad, but I think it's true.
Well, that's just an objective comment, I think.
Her argument is that why am I saying authoritarian daddy and not authoritarian mommy?
Oh,
because it really means daddy in their case.
That's
We're
exactly
describing,
right.
That's like
now,
saying that the KKK needs a white leader. I mean, that's just true.
I suspect that my friend's friend is British.
Yes.
Okay? Because he works in an office with British people.
And we don't like. Let's be clear about that. Not sexist, not in any way homophobic, not racist, but British people don't care for them.
Yeah,
I don't like them. Not nice people.
There's a little bit
They're
of
not nice.
Wait, is this friend
xenophobia?
A male or female? I'm confused now.
No, my friend is male. He was trying to get other people to listen to the show. His friend is female. She took issue with what I was saying.
Hmm.
And I think the problem is maybe, I mean, look, we have a lot of British listeners. In fact, from the entire former empire, I think we have listeners. And so it's not the 1950s I'm talking about. It's maybe closer to the 1750s.
I didn't think that was sexist at all.
No.
I mean, you even went, you rounded out the whole thing. She was even... married to a governor of a state.
She was the first lady of Arkansas.
Right, exactly.
As well.
And that isn't, if you're Hillary Clinton,
I'm sorry,
that is relevant.
Listen, here's the reality. Being a lawyer at a corporate law firm, in my mind, does not make you experienced to be president. That is part of her experience, even working as a legal defense fund or working on, in any of the capacities she had, professionally speaking, those aren't the ones. When people say she is one of the most experienced or suited to be president, or has the most extensive knowledge of what it takes to be president, is the way that people phrase it, it's not a function of her job. It is her function of having been that close to the presidency. I compared it to being a vice president.
You're really, really quite sexist.
Now we're gonna
sort of shocked by your misogyny.
Now we're gonna get criticism about the quality of the British accents.
It's sort of intentionally bad.
All right, well, thank you. That's built into the cake. All right, we're going to take a quick break and go to the fun half. We'll be right back after this.